But that is in the future. Right now, it's time to take a look back in the present to the past with another round of History Matters. And we are joined by Scott Washington, historian extraordinaire, who has spent the last minute and a half playing with this plastic skull that we have here in the studio for our Halloween decorations.
That's right. Alas, poor York.
Just running through that Hamlet monologue, I have no doubt. How are you?
Doing good.
Is it bad that I could tell what Hamlet monologue you were doing when you like picked up the skull and held
right.
it at arm's length?
There aren't many that are like that.
That's true. There also aren't that many things that you can do with a plastic
because
skull.
Because you made that reference to Playmaker, so immediately I went that monologue.
That's why.
Well, this is a really interesting. This is a week then, you know, and when we look at all the different things that happen, the anniversaries of things that happen internationally, nationally, locally, regionally, there are some really interesting, and this one just is just fun. This is just the fun week that has some. I mean, there's a really serious one. We'll get to that in a minute. But let's deal with one thing, and that is, you know, you've seen the $5 bill or the penny with it. If you look really closely, Abraham Lincoln, he has the beard. Well, October 18th, 1860, is when an 11-year-old girl writes the future U.S. president suggesting he should grow a beard. He was clean-shaven. Now, I thought this was an urban legend, but it turns out it's actually true.
Yeah.
I've seen the evidence on this, and it's like, I can't believe it. But whether that was the only thing, but apparently that was at least, she gets the credit.
That's October of 1860, right?
Yes.
That's a heck of a last-minute campaign move, too.
Exactly.
Election day's coming up, you're changing your look, your brand.
Maybe it's because several hundred years earlier, on that same date, October 15th, 1582, is when the Gregorian calendar started. This is Pope Gregory the 13th, and the previous day had been Thursday, October 4th, and then today becomes the 15th. It takes England and its colonies, including America, not until 1752, which means that there's always, and we've talked about this many times, convoluted ideas about when something is being cited as occurring on a certain date. Is it the date that was pre-Gregorian calendar, or is it the same one? And most of them have been correctly updated, but it just means that it creates a certain
confusion.
Kind of
and that's probably confusion at the time as well, especially when you've got two different countries that are operating on two different calendars with two different days. And it just goes to show you that the British have been prickly about these things for hundreds and hundreds of years. When England and the colonies actually joined on to the Gregorian calendar in the 1700s, did they call it Brenter?
You caught me totally by surprise. I have no idea. I'm sure there was a lot. There's a lot of confusion of that because not only was the calendars changing, but also when was New Year's?
And
New Year's was coincided with the spring equinox around March 25th. Of course, the British then finally standardized things to January 1st across the British Empire because there's such confusion as to when it starts. So these are big issues. I've never known whether those are actual elements in terms of the American Revolutionary War, but
probably didn't help.
It didn't.
I can't imagine it helped. Although we still do have different calendars with different New Year's days.
That's
so
right.
That still exists as kind of an interesting thing that
they're different. Well, and if we have the broad perspective, we can say any day can be a new year.
Any day
can be a start.
Nice. I like that.
Yes,
yeah.
Well, you know.
Every day is New Year's Day.
That's right. Well, you know, you had a birthday last week. We were celebrating in your absence. And so we wish you the best this whole new year. So you can just say we've been celebrating New Year's.
So midnight tonight, pop the cork on a bottle of champagne, toast the new year.
That's right.
But then put the cork back in because you're going to have to do this again in 24 hours.
There's no reason why you can't do that. Well, now here's the fun things that come up today. And they're about animals. Now, when we heard the theme music to Masterpiece Theater play at the top, it reminds me of British troops in 1943, World War II, They capture a village in Italy, but their radio is out, and they cannot get word to the Americans to stop the bombings, which are scheduled. They had actually arrived, captured the village, and then are like, oh, my gosh, how are we going to let the Americans know not to bomb it because we're here? And so in desperation, they turn to a carrier pigeon. Now, you know, I'm sure they're going, oh, this is ridiculous, but they send this carrier pigeon named, ironically, G.I. Joe.
Nice.
And the pigeon travels incredibly fast. It travels 20 miles in 20 minutes.
Wow.
I mean, setting up kind of a world pigeon record, whether there was prevailing winds or whatever it was, but it arrives just in time to halt the bombings. You know, they say, "What? Look, what's this pigeon?" And they go, "Oh my gosh, stop the bombers!"
So we've talked about this before, and I'm now suddenly curious as to where in Italy this village is, and it's just a little ways north of Naples, still kind of on the western side of Italy, so kind of between Naples and Rome. So that's where
Calvi Vecchia. That's right.
It's a fascinating story.
Oh my gosh! Well, and it wasn't inconceivable. It saved over 1,000 lives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's quite a lot. So, and the pigeon even was kept, and then it died, and they stuffed it, and they put it in a museum for a while, because this was a noble creature. In fact, I think it even got awards, one of the few animals that got awards because of,
I bet,
you know, of saving so many lives, which is kind of amazing. Now, here's the other one, Aaron, which also happens the same
way. Wait, before you go back, which museum did they put this stuffed bird in?
I believe in the United States, believe it or not.
Okay.
Yeah, because they said... And then
I'm not sure which museum fits that particular exhibit,
but okay. You know, you were mentioning the Tuba Museum the other day.
True.
There is another museum that's of historic interest that maybe not a lot of people don't know about. It's the Tank Museum up in Danville, Virginia.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
It's just, oh my gosh, it's just about an hour north. You go up on 86 and you go into Danville, and this was originally, I believe, on Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And then the residents there say, no, we don't want a lot of tanks. So they moved down to a warehouse, and you can actually go visit this. And it's a phenomenal place because these are real tanks that have been used in multiple wars, and not just like two or three. There seems to be like 100, 200. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And they also have some other kind of exhibits there, but it's very different, and it's a real testimony to something different. So that's you had the Tuba Museum.
We should go,
another one.
The Tuba Museum. See, I think last year, around this time, actually, I was participating in this kind of brainstorming session about, ooh, Chapel Hill, like what cool things would you like to see in Chapel Hill? And I was like, well, let's have some draw, something that brings people in. And we were talking about like what different ideas. And they're like, oh, it's got to be something that relates to Chapel Hill in some way, like something where there's a reason why it would be in Chapel Hill among other places. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. Durham's got a Tuba Museum.
That's
Danville's
right.
got a Tank Museum. Let's just find the cool thing that no one else has done and do that.
And I'm so glad you mentioned it because I have been by the Tuba place many times. I didn't know it was a museum you could actually visit.
Yeah.
So I'm so
Tuesdays
glad I listened
and Thursdays,
to WCHL.
Apparently. Yeah.
It's, you know, this was the place to do it. But
okay, I interrupted your second animal story,
here's
though.
Here's the second one that I just think, it's the same day, October 18th, a different year, 1963. Oh my gosh, you've got to hand it to the French. All right, they're sending, you know, we've sent chimps.
I kind of just want to end the show right there. You got to hand it to the French. And that's it, everyone.
Well, that is true. We have the Eiffel Tower and Statue of Liberty, which this week in 1924 is proclaimed a national monument on October 15th, 1924.
Nice.
But that's not what this is about. This is 1963.
We're going to get to this in a second.
Okay, and I just love it. So the French are saying, we want to send something up into space. And
pourquoi are you speaking English, friend?
No, they don't pick a chimpanzee. They don't pick a dog. They don't send a gerbil or something like this. No, they pick this particular species was a stray found on the streets of Paris and selected from 14 that were trained from the mission. And her name is Felicette, and she's sent into this into space in a capsule on top of her French AG-1 rocket, and travels 120 miles into space for 1 hour and 20 minutes, and then returned to Earth by parachute and was recovered safely.
And this is a cat.
Yes!
First cat in space.
It's a cat.
Yeah.
The only cat to have been sent into space and survived. I mean, you know, you think... You mean in all the other years, nobody's thought, maybe we should try a different animal? No, this is the only time, and I just find that just astonishing.
I want to know if she, like, just completely freaked out on the trip, or if she was one of those, like, chill cats that just kind of sat there staring out the window, went up, came back down, walked out, and said, tuna, please. It's one or the other.
That's right.
There's no middle ground with cats.
Is he immune? Oh, sorry, that's
You're not sorry at all.
But, I mean, that's just one of those great things that you say, this actually happened in history. And, you know, it's set against all the other stuff that we normally look at that's serious. This is the week when Martin Luther King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yep.
On October 19th, 1964.
Yep.
That's right. And 1983, on October 19th, is when Martin Luther King Day actually went into effect, the first annual holiday, a federal holiday,
yep,
honoring an African-American. So, I mean, these are good things, and but there are the little fun things that are just kind of like capricious, and how the French thought of a cat.
Sending a cat into space.
Jacques, what do you think? Oh, a cat.
Sure, why not? Fromage for everybody.
Exactly.
I am Dracula now for some reason. My French accent has gone way off the
rails.
Right.
That's really weird. And the other one.
Doing so well there for like two words.
And then, yeah. Well, here's the other one that is on that same October 19th. When Martin Luther King Day goes into effect, and it's on October 19th, 1781. Now, you may not hear it anywhere else, but you will hear it here, is when Lord Cornwallis surrendered more than 8,000 troops at Yorktown, effectively ending the Revolutionary War. It takes another 2 years, mm-hmm, and we have British troops here during that time while the peace treaty is worked out, but that's the big deal. And, of course, part of that has a real North Carolina connection because when Cornwallis was chasing Nathanael Greene, the American general, across the Carolinas, and he had burned his baggage train and ends up getting into chasing the wrong army because they set up a deception up to the Dan River, and then he's forced hills when he can't get across because the only ferry is operated by someone who is married to the American force, then Cornwallis has to come back down to Hillsborough, and it's not a good time, and eventually he moves somewhere else and then fights Nathanael Greene, or rather Nathanael Greene chooses his time, which is March 15th, which was not the Ides of March, which was not good for Caesar, and it was not good for Cornwallis. He retreats to Wilmington, even though historians say technically Cornwallis won, but his force is decimated by a quarter. He retreats to Wilmington and then eventually goes to Yorktown, and that's where he's besieged by George Washington, and the French blockade the harbor so that the British fleet cannot rescue Cornwallis and he's forced to surrender. So that's the interesting kind of North Carolina connection with all this, which is, I think, significant, and a local connection.
Awesome.
With Hillsborough, too.
Speaking with Scott Washington, History Matters. We got time for one more. What do you got?
Okay. Here is one. I mean, this is another one. You know I love this one. It's 1928, and there was this employee for GE.
Ah, yes.
The General Electric's National Electric Lamp Company, named Marvin Pipkin. And great, and we've always
another
about
good historical another, name.
And
yeah,
what they would do for fun for new employees is they would assign them an impossible task, and in this case, the impossible task was a light bulb that was frosted on the inside, and as far as the engineers knew, couldn't be done. Well, Marvin Pipkin was not in on the joke. He didn't know that, and he treated it seriously, and came up with a way to do it. And dumbfounded, the people there, like, that's impossible. And, you know, it just says so much about whether it's Cats in Space or defeating Cornwallis, the greatest general and the Revolutionary War on the British side, or Martin Luther King winning the Nobel Peace Prize, or even a pigeon going across that great distance and saving so many lives. Sometimes it's the impossible that makes history the most compelling. And every day we all have that chance to do that too.
And that is History Matters for this week. As always, Scott Washington, thank you so much.
Aaron, appreciate it.